Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. In this program, we look back at the Gemini missions that were integral to NASA achieving President John F. Kennedy's goal of having American astronauts on the moon by the end of the 1960s. The solo astronaut Mercury program ended in 1963. And while those flights garnered headlines with familiar names like Alan Shepard, John Glenn, and Gus Grissom, achieving both fame and hero status for being the first Americans in space, they were really pretty primitive missions and went into space for relatively brief periods of time, from 15 minutes to a day and a half. But to get to the moon, astronauts would need to accomplish so much more. They'd need to be in space for at least 10 days and figure out how to get two spacecraft to meet up in orbit and dock, a complex orbital ballet taking place at tens of thousands of miles per hour. And they'd have to get out of the spacecraft in a pressure suit, operating in the dangerous vacuum of space with temperature swings of 500 degrees. It was difficult and dangerous, but the story has been rather lost between the glories of America's first space flights from 1961 to 1963 to when the Apollo 11 astronauts achieved the goal of landing on the moon and returning safely to the Earth in 1969. Joining us to talk about the amazing stories of Gemini or Gemini, more on the pronunciation difference soon, we are joined by Jeffrey Kluger. Jeffrey is a widely respected journalist and author who helped Jim Lovell write the book about Apollo 13 that was turned into the famous movie. He also authored an authoritative book about the historic Apollo 8 mission, the first to leave Earth orbit and travel to the moon at Christmas time in 1968. Kluger's new book is titled Gemini, Stepping Stone to the Moon, The Untold Story. He joins us now. Jeffrey Kluger, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Well, I wanted to make sure that I pronounced the name correctly, so let's start there. Okay. Because as a lifelong amateur astronomer, the constellation containing Castor and Pollux, the two brightest stars, is called Gemini.
Correct.
But if you're talking about these missions, you say Gemini. You want to explain that?
Yeah, I think a lot of it began with the fact that back in the early 1960s, astrology wasn't as popular as it would become in the 70s and 80s and beyond. The people who were designing the Gemini spacecraft and were building the program needed a name for it. They called it Gemini, but they weren't really familiar with the pronunciation. So within NASA, it became mispronounced as Gemini. Well, once NASA built that up, once that seemed to become the lingua franca of NASA, it became sort of a shibboleth. It was a code word. If you knew what you were doing, if you were part of the program, you said Gemini. You didn't say Gemini. And it got to the point that newscasters were asking NASA, which was the proper pronunciation, people like Walter Cronkite and Jules Bergman, who were space junkies from the moment they were born, were always saying Gemini. Other newscasters said Gemini. And then in about, I think it was 1964, I read the small piece in the New York Times in which NASA declared officially that the pronunciation was Gemini. And they said that this was a decision made by some complex title, Nomenclature and Naming Committee, which didn't exist. There was no such thing as a Nomenclature and Naming Committee, but they decided to give it the imprimatur of a NASA panel that would call it Gemini. I have often referred to it as Gemini when I'm talking about the program and Gemini when I'm talking about a specific mission. So that's sort of where I've shaken out in that.
Yeah, that's getting subtle there. And just for the record, I'm not interested in astrology whatsoever, but as an astronomer, you know, the zodiacal constellation is Gemini.
Right.
And it has the Geminid meteor shower, and it's exactly. Very cool. And I always thought it was appropriately named since Gemini is the twins.
Right, exactly. And that's why they named it that. It was originally, there was some talk about sort of making more of a claim to its descent, to its parentage, the Mercury's program. Mm-hmm. And there was some talk about naming it Mercury Mark II, which doesn't have the feel of Gemini or Gemini. I think it was the right choice. And they actually, there was one engineer, I forget where he was. I think it was at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, who submitted. There was a contest, and they said anybody, you know, anyone and everyone who worked for NASA was free to submit a name, and they would win a bottle of scotch if the name was chosen. And it was an engineer at NASA Goddard who formally, officially proposed Gemini, and that was accepted, and he got his bottle of scotch.
Very cool. Well, let's talk about what made you want to tackle this subject, because I thought it was great as a longtime fan of the space program who grew up during this era. And as a child, I was too young for Mercury. I mean, I was like 3 and a half when the last flight flew. So I really don't have memories of that. But I do have memories of the Gemini program.
Right.
I certainly do have that. I'm watching it on TV as a kid. So what made you want to tackle this subject? Because I think it's pretty neat that there's so much been written about the Right Stuff era, Mercury, and so much written about the moon program, Apollo, but not very much about this one.
Right. And that's exactly what my thinking was at the time. I've been thinking about this book for the past 15 years or so. And what compelled me, you know, what interested me the most is exactly what you said. You know, Tom Wolfe in 1979, when The Right Stuff came out, basically laid claim to that entire topic. Nobody is going to try to write the definitive Mercury book again, you know, maybe a century before someone else would come back to it. The book is so good and so thorough and so smart that no one's going to attempt to touch it. I've written about Mercury. I wrote about it in Apollo 8 a little bit, and Apollo 13 a little bit, and a little bit more in Gemini, but I would never propose to do a book about it. Similarly, as you say, you know, a lot of people have written about the Apollo program. I wrote about Apollos 8 and 13. Andy Chaikin wrote what I consider the definitive book on the Apollo program, A Man on the Moon. And certainly astronauts and flight directors have, in their autobiographies, written a great deal about the Apollo program. But Gemini was the middle child. Gemini was the middle seat in a transcontinental flight in coach. It just was overlooked. It was passed over. And I think it was because it didn't have the first time energy that Mercury had, the first man in space, the first American in space, the first American to orbit the Earth, the first American to stay in space for more than 24 hours. You know, those were all flag planting firsts that got people excited. Apollo had its built-in appeal with the fact that we were going to a different world for the first time. And Gemini got overlooked as a transitional program. But it was in Gemini where we learned to walk in space, where we learned to rendezvous and dock in space, where we learned to fly long-duration missions. Jim Lovell and Frank Borman were aloft for 14 days between December 4th and December 18th. Today is the anniversary of their splashdown. It's unfathomable. It's like 2 weeks in a VW Beetle. But, you know, Gemini was able to put all of those points on the board, to score all of those achievements. And I thought, you know, the fact that it never got the attention it deserved was a wrong that needed to be righted.
What struck me reading your book was just how fascinating a story it is, with so many twists and turns and engineering decisions, and it kind of lets you know kind of the fragility of the space program back then, if I put it that way, that it was, you know, so also brand new. Nobody knew how to do these things. You maybe talk a bit about it? You've kind of mentioned that it was the bridge from, okay, we can get guys into space, we can do that, and then we were going to the moon. But in order to go to the moon, We've got to do these other things. We, like you said, we've got to have two spacecraft meet up in orbit. We've got to have them literally dock together. We've got to go outside of a spacecraft. We have to stay out for, you know, 10 days, couple weeks, because a trip to the moon's more than a day.
Right.
So talk a bit about, you know, how Kennedy's challenge to go to the moon in 1961, because you write about it quite eloquently, how that led to this, like, oh, gosh, we got to do all this stuff.
Right. Well, Kennedy's goal in his speech before Congress on May 25th, 1961, which was only 3 months and 3 days.
It was just right after the first flight with Alan Shepard.
Right after Mercury. Mm-hmm. It was right after Alan Shepard's mission.
15 minutes, didn't even go into orbit. And then Kennedy tells the country, hey, we're going to the moon.
Exactly. And he framed it as before the end of the decade. But his secret goal, which he didn't publicize, was to have the first landing in 1967 in order to spit in the soup of the Soviets' 50th anniversary of their revolution. It was going to be a big national celebration. They imagined, it would get a lot of global attention. But an American on the moon would clearly eclipse that. So I don't think NASA really believed it needed a Gemini program at first. I think once they built, and actually this is what the reporting shows, that once they built the Mercury ships and proved that they could get men in space and proved that they could orbit them for more than a day, Gordon Cooper was up for 33 hours, 22 orbits, they felt they could go quiet for a while, that the launch pads could go cold for a while they built the Apollo spacecraft. But the more people began looking into the complexity of lunar orbit rendezvous, which was, the method chosen to go to the moon, as opposed to a direct mission, just fly a spacecraft out there, land that spacecraft on the surface, bring it back up and fly home. No one could figure out how to do single stage to orbit like that. So it needed to be done piecemeal. You needed to have two vehicles, one that would go down to the lunar surface, one that would stay in orbit. And, NASA came to realize it didn't have the ability to do any of those things. It didn't know how to rendezvous in space. NASA didn't know how to dock in space. No American had spacewalked yet. No American had flown for anywhere near the length of a lunar mission. So it became more and more evident that an intermediate program was needed in which all of these skills could be tried. And, they recruited an enormous fraternity, well, not an enormous fraternity, but an extraordinary fraternity of men to fly these missions. It was, it was Gemini that gave us the Mount Rushmore names, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and Jim Lovell and John Young and Pete Conrad and Gene Cernan. Certainly, these guys were giants. And they had exactly the skills that were needed to fly these missions.
We had the original Mercury 7, the great Life magazine heroes, right. John Glenn and Alan Shepard being, chief among them. But out of those original seven, only three, as I recall, flew in Gemini. And only Wally Schirra would fly an Apollo mission, the first one, Apollo 7. So, they really needed, a bunch of more astronauts. So they had a group of nine, the nine astronauts, and you named some of the big ones there, Armstrong, Jim Lovell, Pete Conrad, and then the third group of 14. So they really had to bring in a lot of astronauts, didn't they?
Right, they did. And I mean, they were going through them two at a time in the Gemini program, and they were going to go through them three at a time in the Apollo program. And, Apollo was originally slated to go up to Apollo 20. So, these were the first Apollo mission. There were 14 Apollo missions were initially planned, plus 10 Gemini missions. And, these guys had to be training fast and flying quickly when, again, the Gemini missions were about 2 months apart. The Apollo missions flew about 3 months apart. Apollo 8 flew in December of 68, Apollo 9 flew in February of 69, Apollo 10 flew in May of 69. So these, they were stacking up rockets, rolling them to the pad, popping them off, at a rate that certainly the Soviets weren't matching. And I'm not even sure NASA was convinced that it would be able to keep flying at that rate until it did. So they needed a lot of men to fly these missions. And, they recruited a lot of men. And most of them did get a chance to fly, at least in Apollo, if not in Gemini. A handful of them, like Jack Lausma, and I think Owen Garriott, didn't fly until Skylab, but they at least were flying on Apollo hardware.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with author Jeffrey Kluger as we talk about his new book, Gemini, Stepping Stone to the Moon, The Untold Story. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. And thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we talk to author Jeffrey Kluger. In his new book, Gemini, Stepping Stone to the Moon, he tells the story of the mid-1960s Gemini program that literally taught NASA how to operate in space proficiently enough to attempt the Apollo missions that would spectacularly explore the moon from 1968 to 1972. This is really, to me, the golden age of NASA leadership in the 1960s, yeah, when they really did some bold things and kind of cut through the old red tape. Let's start with James Webb. Tell us about him and his role.
Webb had been with, he had been in the government before. He was an undersecretary of state in, I think, the Eisenhower administration. And then he went off into the private sector and was working for the oil industry in Oklahoma until Lyndon Johnson summoned him back to service. Now, Webb didn't necessarily want to go. He was making much better money in the private sector. He didn't much care for Washington anymore. He didn't much care for Lyndon Johnson anymore. He had gotten a belly full of Johnson when he was working in the government, and Johnson was majority leader of the Senate, and Johnson could wear on people easily. So Webb wasn't all that excited about the mission, about NASA as his next career goal. But Johnson summoned him to the White House when he was vice president, browbeat him essentially into taking the job, and then sent him off the next day to meet with President Kennedy. And, you know, by the time he got to Kennedy's office, it was clear that, I mean, this was the president asking him to serve. So he stepped up and served. He ran the agency very vigorously, very aggressively. When he landed there, it was 1962, he kind of whipped the program along, seeing to it that it stayed on that, on the schedule that it was maintaining of, you know, frequency of flights and frequency of training. So he was very much a man with his foot on the accelerator, seeing to it that NASA continued flying. And he didn't leave. He left right before Apollo 8, which was an interesting time to leave because, you know, he knew that was going to be the first lunar orbit. And you would have thought he wanted to stay around until then. But he gave this space agency a good 5 years and set it up to succeed once Apollo started flying.
And another really key leader of this time period is Chris Kraft, Christopher Columbus Kraft Jr., the very first flight director. Talk a bit about his role, because he really has an amazing story he is.
Yeah, he is a wonderfully smart, wonderfully quick, wonderfully profane man who suffered fools not well at all. And, you know, he demanded the absolute most from his teams. He demanded it from Gene Kranz. He demanded it, who was his second in command in mission control. He certainly demanded it from his astronauts. And he wanted these people to be autonomous. During Gemini 5, Kraft and Kranz were rotating on the flight director's console. And Kranz often talks about a time during that flight when it wasn't in trouble, but it was having problems with its fuel cells. It was having problems with its orientation. It had a lot of little glitches, a lot of gremlins in the system that had to be worked out. And Kranz said when they were doing the shift handover, when, you know, Kranz was leaving the flight director's console to go out and do a press conference, and Kranz was taking over, he asked Kraft, you know, what do you want me to be doing on this cycle? And Kraft turned to him and said, it's your mission. It's your shift. You do it. You figure it out. And Kranz said that was a really bracing moment for him because, you know, Kraft was just basically dumping the mission into his lap, but telling him, you have the wherewithal to fly, to run this mission. He grounded some astronauts over the course of his career for either poor performance or insubordination. He grounded Scott Carpenter, who was flying a three-orbit mission very similar to John Glenn's, but spent way too much time stargazing and way too much time spinning his capsule around, dancing it this way and that. Wasted a whole lot of fuel and came down 250 miles off target. So Kraft grounded him.
Well, let's also talk about the design of the Gemini spacecraft. And Maxine Faget is a really interesting character in the history of the space program. You hear like the Artemis program and the Orion spacecraft now that's hopefully going to go to the moon next year, referred to as Apollo on steroids. And kind of in a way, Gemini was like Mercury on steroids a bit. Tell us about the design of this spacecraft.
The spacecraft there was some talk early in the Gemini program of building just a souped up one person spacecraft. It would be Mercury again, but it would be a little bit bigger, a little bit more capable, and it would still fly just one man. And they presented that option. McDonnell Aviation presented that option to NASA. And as an afterthought, they also designed a two-person spacecraft, which NASA fell for immediately. Now, one of the advantages of the Gemini spacecraft was the Mercury was so small that all of its systems, all of its instruments, all of its life support equipment, its oxygen tank, its helium burst tank, its fuel tanks, they all had to be built sort of into the skin of the spacecraft. So if you had to do any maintenance work, you had to basically go into the spacecraft, pull out the instrument panel, and then look for whatever system it was that you needed to work on. The Gemini had what was called an adapter section, you know, a big detachable section at the back that housed the retro rockets. And, you know, that provided plenty of room to put oxygen tanks and put helium tanks and put fuel tanks. And, you know, it was sort of like they were able to throw these components into the trunk of a car. And the engineers, paradoxically, even though it was an infinitely more complex spacecraft because it had to accommodate two men, because it needed more elaborate flight support or life support systems, because it needed more elaborate navigation systems, a better computer, and it needed, you know, a whole array of thrusters that Mercury didn't have. But it was, in many respects, for the engineers, an easier spacecraft to build because that adapter section provided a place to put all of these components so they could pull things in and out as they did maintenance work. So, you know, all of that made Gemini a much more nimble spacecraft than Mercury was, you know, and a much more capable one.
And another, you touched on it a bit, talking about Walter Cronkite and Jules Bergman and people like that. Another aspect of these missions, like Mercury, was that this was a big deal in the United States with the media, with the press, print and television. It really was a different era. Can you maybe just describe a little bit of that for folks that are just, you know, too young to remember what that was like?
Sure. Yeah, it was really bracing and heartening to see the way the nation took to this. You know, the shuttle flew 135 times. And if you stop the average person on the street and ask them at any point during the 30 years that the shuttle flew, is there a shuttle in space right now? Are there any astronauts in space? 90% of the people wouldn't even know. Similarly, if you ask people, you know, about the International Space Station, the vast majority of people do not know that the station has been continually occupied from 2000 to the present. November 2nd, 2000 was the day the first crew came aboard, and it has never been empty since then. So for 25 years, there have always been at least a handful of people who live on the Earth who were not on the Earth. In the case of Gemini, there was a real gathering around the national campfire every time that spacecraft flew. There was a 15-foot by 15-foot screen built in Grand Central Terminal that showed the liftoffs, that showed the splashdowns, that showed the coverage. You know, I remember, I'm old enough to remember being in school, and during the Gemini programs, Gemini missions, they would roll TVs into the classrooms and you would have your lessons, but fewer during the course of the day because there would be a lot of time set aside to watch the missions. You know, liftoff was, there were, I think for Gemini 4, they credentialed 1,100, 1,200 reporters to the Johnson Space Center. The auditorium at JSC, it wasn't called JSC then, it was MSC, the Manned Spacecraft Center. The auditorium there only seated 700 people, and they had 1,100 journalists. Nobody expected the kind of wall-to-wall coverage these missions had. And it continued straight through all 10 missions. People did not tire of the Gemini missions. There was round-the-clock coverage. There was, you know, constant newspaper coverage. In writing this book, I went back to a lot of old New York Times pieces. And even small maneuvers, small issues like the fuel cell problems on Gemini 5 would get huge coverage in the New York Times because people were on top of these missions. They were excited about these missions. It was a foot race to get through them, to accomplish everything they needed to accomplish, and then get on to Apollo. And, you know, the country was along for the ride in a way that they haven't been now. It's one of the reasons that I'm excited about Artemis II, which will fly around the moon, take astronauts around the moon for the first time in 53 years, as early as February. And the hope is that we'll see that kind of coverage and that kind of national excitement again in 2026.
Yeah, and one of my favorite Lovell stories about the astronauts that you have in the book is when he went by the name of Max Peck. Could you just briefly tell that story?
Sure. Yeah. Deke Slayton was getting tired of the press. You know, they hounded him. They were asking him questions that he wasn't prepared to answer. They demanded a great deal of his time. And when he selected the new nine astronauts, he needed them all to come to Houston and be prepared to go over to the Manned Spacecraft Center, or actually it was Rice University where they were introduced, where they could have, you know, the formal introduction to the press. He did not want the media, especially Aviation Week, was always hot on these stories. And his suspicion was that somebody had leaked the names of the astronauts, that that Aviation Week got a hold of it, that other outlets got a hold of it, and they would be, their cover would be blown before they could have their formal introduction at Rice University. So he had all nine astronauts come to Houston and check into rooms at the Rice Hotel. But every one of them was told to check in under the name Max Peck. And there was a poor young woman who was the concierge who was checking them in. And one by one, they would come up and introduce themselves as Max Peck. Well, Max Peck not only wasn't their name, it was the name of the manager of the hotel. And the girl got very flummoxed, and her boss came up behind her and said, "Yes, Mr. Peck, welcome to the Rice Hotel," and sent every one of the astronauts up to their rooms under the name of Max Peck. And that was Deke Slayton's way of getting the press away from the hotel so he could have his formal introduction at Rice University.
Yeah, that is hilarious. Okay, let's get back to the spacecraft, because anytime you're engineering something like this that's new, trying to do new things, you're going to have all kinds of problems. So let's start, like, you know, one of the things that I found really interesting, and I recall this as a kid, is let's talk about liftoff. You know, when you had the Mercury and then later Apollo, you had a launch escape system with a rocket that could just pull that capsule off that giant booster to get it to safety, hopefully. Talk about what they ran into and what they decided to do with Gemini.
Sure. The launch escape system was a tower built on the nose of the spacecraft that had three solid fuel, very powerful solid fuel engines. And if the onboard computer detected any problem in the booster, in the rocket, as it was lifting off, the engines would fire, the capsule would detach, and the crew would be flown to safety a few thousand feet away and parachute down to Earth. There was absolutely no reason not to use that system on Gemini as well, except that it was heavy. It added 1,360 some pounds to the weight of the spacecraft. And the Gemini was so instrument dense, it was so filled with, you know, fuel cells and fuel tanks and, you know, all manner of other hardware, that every pound they could save on an escape system was a pound they could add to the spacecraft's instrumentation. So the brain trust of Gemini decided to go with ejection seats instead. Now, on its surface, that made a lot of sense. It did away with the tower. It saved 1,300 pounds. All of the astronauts were very familiar with ejection seats. They had them in their planes, many of them during test flights. They were test pilots, and many of them had to use them when a plane was augering into the Earth. So this seemed like a sensible solution, but they could never quite get the system right. You know, they would fire the ejection seats and the doors, the hatch would fail to open. It would be 50 milliseconds late in opening, which caused the ejection seats basically just a pancake against the interior door of the spacecraft, which would have killed the astronauts. You know, the chutes got tangled. When they flew test flights, plenty of ejection seats that were being tested just crashed into the desert floor. And even if the seats were successful, they would have subjected the astronauts to a force of 20 Gs, which is much more than they had ever taken in centrifuges, much more than they had ever taken in their planes. You know, there was real concern that if they ever had to use the ejection seats, the astronauts would be injured or even killed just, you know, by the G-forces. But by the time people started having second thoughts about the ejection seats, all of the weight that was saved by putting the by getting rid of the escape tower had already been accounted for by new hardware being introduced into the spacecraft. So they would not have been able to do away with the to put the escape tower back on the spacecraft because there just wasn't any weight margin left. So they were more or less stuck with the ejection seats.
Yeah, and then another aspect, you know, once they got into orbit, you wanted to be up there for a long time. This was the first use of fuel cells, which is a way to produce electricity. And, you know, as a byproduct, you also get water because you're combining hydrogen and oxygen, essentially. But those didn't turn out to work too well initially either.
No, they were first tested aboard Gemini 5, which was an 8-day mission, which broke the record at that time for longevity, longer than any Americans had been up and twice as long as any Soviets had been up. And they very much needed fuel cells because batteries just wouldn't last you for the entire time of a long duration mission. But the fuel cells, they combine oxygen and hydrogen and produce two very useful byproducts. They produce potable water and they produce energy. They produce electricity. Well, that's terrific. You need the electricity and you can save on your, you can save weight because you don't have to pack potable water with you. You don't have to pack potable water in tanks in the spacecraft. You're getting it from your fuel cells. The problem was the cells, at least for the first few missions, were never operating as efficiently as they were supposed to. Pressure was always falling in them. The water that it was producing tended to swamp the fuel cells. Some of the cells, you know, nearly drowned, and the astronauts took to storing the water in urine bags just to, you know, to find a place to put it. And it took until Gemini 7 when Jim Lovell and Frank Borman were up for 14 days before the fuel cells were actually perfected. It was a very old technology. The idea of a fuel cell was first developed in the 19th century, but fuel cells, as they were built, were huge. They were, you know, bookshelf size, and these had to be shrunk down to about the size of a briefcase. So there was a lot of miniaturization that went on. There was a lot of re-engineering to prevent the cells from flooding. And a lot of that was worked out in the flights themselves, not just in the preliminary design. But, you know, it was troubleshot in real time during the course of the missions.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with author Jeffrey Kluger as we talk about his new book, Gemini, Stepping Stone to the Moon, The Untold Story. I'm Dave Schlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we visit with Jeffrey Kluger. In his new book, Gemini, Stepping Stone to the Moon, he tells the mostly unknown story of the two-man Gemini spacecraft that helped NASA master spaceflight enough in the mid-1960s to pave the way for the Apollo moon missions. One of my favorite stories in the book is it's kind of gives you a little bit of a sense of how Wild West things were back in the beginning. Let's talk about the delicatessen incident on the first flight.
On the very first flight, yes. John Young, the first flight was Gus Grissom and John Young. And Grissom, I describe in the book as solid, stolid, concrete made flesh. And he was a man who brooked no nonsense. He was a little bit like Chris Kraft in that respect. John Young flew in the co-pilot seat on that mission. Young was a rookie. He's a very taciturn guy, a very businesslike guy, and not one to play pranks or, be anything other than utterly professional. But before he flew, before the mission happened, the astronauts had long been complaining about the quality of the food that was used in the Mercury program and was going to be used in the Gemini program. It was all freeze-dried and pureed. It was either biscuits or baby food, basically. And Wally Schirra wanted to make the point that there were better ways to eat. So the day before Gemini 3 launched, he went to Wolfie's Delicatessen in Cocoa Beach. Bought a corned beef sandwich, gave it to John Young, and told him to take it up with him into orbit. Well, Young, who never would have done that kind of thing in his life, was given a choice, was stuck between either complying and breaking mission rules or disobeying a suggestion from Wally Schirra, who was a Mercury astronaut. He was NASA royalty, and you just couldn't say no to Wally Schirra. So he smuggled the sandwich. He took it into the suit up room with him, smuggled it into the pocket of his spacesuit. They got into orbit and he produced it and began eating it and offered a bite to Grissom. And Grissom said, "Where did that come from?" And Young said, "I brought it with me." Grissom took one bite, saw crumbs come forming around the spacecraft, confiscated the sandwich, put it away. And in the museum display of Wally Schirra's career, there is a corned beef sandwich in a Lucite brick to this day. Not the same sandwich, but it is, a commemoration of one of Wally's better
Yeah,
pranks.
that's a pretty hilarious story. And but there were some stories that were not hilarious, very harrowing. There were some moments during the Gemini program that were truly frightening. Let's start with what happened to Neil Armstrong and Dave Scott on their mission, because that one, a lot of people don't know about that. That was a very scary time.
That was a really dangerous time. Neil Armstrong and Dave Scott were tapped to fly Gemini 8. And the mission patch was one of the best ways of illustrating what the mission was going to involve. The mission patch showed two stars on the left side, which represented the two astronauts, shedding light through a prism, which broke into the colors of the rainbow. And it was Dave Scott's idea. And that was a way of stating that this was going to be a full spectrum mission. It was going to do basically everything that Gemini was designed to do. It was going to be up for 4 days, which was pretty long at that point. There was going to be a rendezvous and docking with the Agena, the first rendezvous and docking ever attempted. And Dave Scott was going to take a spacewalk that would last more than 90 minutes, which meant that it would be a complete orbit. And the newspapers were already running stories with headlines like, "Dave Scott is going to be the first man to walk around the world." And that was if you call a spacewalk a walk, that was absolutely true. So on the very first day of the mission, an hour, 90 minutes before they lifted off, the Agena docking vehicle, which was a 26-foot long tube, basically, with a docking port at one end and an engine at the other end, it was launched 90 minutes before the astronauts were launched. Exactly 90 minutes after it went off, when the Agena was in orbit and just overhead of Cape Canaveral, Gemini 8 lifted off and gave chase to the Agena. Within the first three orbits, they had successfully rendezvoused with the Agena, which had never been done before. They had successfully docked with the Agena, which had never been done before. And it was basically now two vehicles that were mated as one flying around the Earth. The plan was for them to undock a couple of times and redock to make sure they had the system perfected. Then they were going to fire the Agena engine and fly up to a higher altitude to prove that they could do that kind of orbital maneuvering. And all of that was set for later in the first day. But during a blackout period, there were no satellites that kept the spacecraft in constant touch with NASA. Instead, there was sort of a necklace of tracking stations around the world. So Canary Islands would be communicating with the spacecraft for about 15, 16 minutes. Then there would be a 10-minute blackout, and then Hawaii would pick up the communication, and it would go this way around the world with periodic blackouts, no communication blackouts. And during one of those blackouts, shortly after they docked, the spacecraft began going into a slow roll, which Armstrong could not stop. He tried firing counter thrusters to stop the roll, but the roll simply continued. It began accelerating up to the point that it was accelerating to 60 revolutions per minute, which was one revolution per second, which is the rate at which vertigo can set in. They determined, or Armstrong determined, that the problem was a stuck thruster in the Agena. So he separated from the Agena, which sort of spun away from the spacecraft, and the Gemini simply continued spinning. He finally came to the only conclusion he could, which was that the problem was in the Gemini's thrusters, and Armstrong was able, just through deft flying, to fire counter thrusters and slowly bring the spacecraft under control. But in order to do that, they had to break into a secondary thruster system, the reentry control system, which was used only for return to Earth. And once those thrusters were used, the spacecraft was considered unfit to fly anymore because they needed to conserve every ounce of fuel they had in the reentry system. So the flight that was supposed to be 4 days lasted only 10 hours, and they splashed down in the Pacific safely. But it was a really harrowing mission. And I spoke to Dave Scott about this when he was one of the technical advisors on Apollo 13, when we were shooting that back in 94. And I spoke to him on the set about it. And he said, yeah, he nearly blacked out. And had he blacked out and had Armstrong blacked out, the spacecraft simply would have continued spinning until the vertigo caused heart damage, and it would have killed them had Armstrong not been able to bring the roll under control.
Yeah, it's just a very scary story. And then another one is the problems with EVAs, spacewalks, was it looked real easy when Ed White did it on the first American spacewalk. But boy, Gene Cernan in particular, it could get very dicey. Just tell us about what nearly happened with Gene Cernan and Tom Stafford.
Cernan calls that spacewalk the spacewalk from hell, and it very much was. You're right that it looked easy with Ed White, because he didn't have to do much. He was only out for 21 minutes. He was simply supposed to drift around the spacecraft. He had a little hand-controlled thruster. It was a trigger handle with two wands coming out of either side and a nozzle at the end, and he could spray hydrogen peroxide gas through it, which would push him one way or another, and he got very good at it. So it was a very easy EVA for him, extravehicular activity or spacewalk. And he was out and he was in, and the whole thing was over in 21 minutes. Cernan's spacewalk was supposed to be much longer and much more complex than that. It called for him to exit the spacecraft, to make his way to the back, to the adapter section, where a maneuvering backpack was stored. It was called the Astronaut Maneuvering Unit, designed by the Air Force. He was supposed to disconnect his umbilical, don the astronaut maneuvering unit, fly that around the spacecraft, finish that up, put the AMU away, and get back into the spacecraft. From the moment he got outside, physics started having its way with him. It became very difficult to control the umbilical cord, which the astronauts called the snake. And every time he would try to maneuver one way, if he tried to maneuver right, there would be a reaction sending him left. If he tried to maneuver away, the physics would pull him back. It became very difficult for him to maneuver. There were a series of handholds on the spacecraft that he was able to grab hold of and eventually work his way back to the adapter section where the AMU was stored. But he found that he was becoming so overheated that his visor was fogging, and that was on the daylit side of the Earth. On the nighttime side of the Earth, the visor froze over and basically blinded him. He obviously had no way of wiping the interior of the visor, with the exception of his nose, which he did use to press against the visor and clear a little spot that he could see through. When he finally got back to the end of the spacecraft where the AMU was stored, he noticed a jagged piece of metal where the rocket, where the Titan had attached to the spacecraft before it separated. And, you know, that metal, obviously, he had to avoid because, you know, it could have easily slashed his suit open. He finally got into the adapter section. The AMU wasn't working as it should. His heart rate was accelerating. It was 155 beats per minute at one point, which was the equivalent of a man running up 55 flights of steps. It continued to accelerate. He continued to be roasted when the spacecraft was in the sunlit side of the Earth and freeze over when it was in the nighttime side of the Earth. And finally, Tom Stafford called an end to it, called an abort, and, you know, insisted that the spacewalk be canceled and that Cernan climb back inside.
Easier said than done, huh?
Much easier said than done. He could. One of the problems with the spacesuit was that when it was inflated, it became very difficult to move. If you look at pictures of Dave Scott when he returned from the moon after Apollo 15 and did a press conference, if you look at his hands in that press conference, it looks like he's wearing dark nail polish. That was the result of having to work in gloves that resisted, because they were inflated, that resisted his movement. He had to use every ounce of muscle he had in his hands to grip instruments, to grip tools. And ultimately, that caused, you know, tiny capillaries to burst between underneath his fingernails, which stayed with him for months until his nails grew out. This was a similar problem that Cernan faced climbing back into the spacecraft. He could not bend enough to get into the seat. He finally was sort of inside the half inside the spacecraft, half outside the spacecraft. And he said to Tom Stafford, if I have to stand like this much longer, I'm not going to make it. Stafford finally helped him get back inside, get seated, and get the hatch closed. But before they had taken off, when they were in the suit up room, Gene Cernan approached the two men and said he wanted to have a private word with Stafford. He took Stafford off to the side, and he told him essentially that the goal, of course, was to send two men into space and bring two men home. But if Cernan became disabled outside the spacecraft, Stafford was not to stay in orbit and die along with him. He was to cut him loose, close the hatch, and fly home alone. Stafford accepted the order, went back to continue suiting up, and Cernan said, what was that all about? And Stafford said, nothing to worry about, Gino, and just left it at that. So that was in Stafford's head throughout the entire spacewalk. Happily, he didn't have to make that choice, but this was the edict that Slayton had established before he'd fly.
Yeah, I've talked to Tom Stafford about that when he was alive, and it definitely was a hairy moment in his life and, yeah, and Gene Cernan's. Put this into context for us, because it's so amazing to me, and you know, we've mentioned some of these harrowing moments, and there were some great triumphs too. Of, you know, learning how to do all of these things, stay in space for long periods of time, to actually, you know, by the time Buzz Aldrin goes on his EVA spacewalk on the final flight with Jim Lovell, you know, he's able to do it, you know, proficiently.
Right.
And, you know, we learn how to overcome these problems. And that all leads to, you know, eventually, you know, in 1968, being able to go to the moon.
Right. It was the discipline of ticking off these boxes. It was effectively an engineering checklist. We must learn these skills. We must build this hardware. We must fly these missions. And EVA is a very good example of that, because Cernan's EVA was not easy. On Gemini 10, Mike Collins' EVA was not easy. They all had exhaustion problems. They all had heart rate problems. And it wasn't until Gemini 12 that NASA learned to build in rest periods to slow the pace of the spacewalk down, to limit what the astronauts did, and to do their work slowly. And, you know, Aldrin went on three different spacewalks and was out for a total of 5.5 hours, which was unheard of before. So there was just a discipline. There was an engineer's discipline to, you know, finding the next target and moving the next target. Jim Lovell, when he was on flying Apollo 13, he said that, you know, he often saw their effort to get back to Earth as sort of a solitaire game. And as long as you have another card to turn over, the game continues. The game only ends when you're out of cards to turn over. And he said, happily, they never got to that point. And I think that was the case with Gemini as well, programmatically. You know, they always had another card to turn over. They always had another achievement to notch. And, you know, they were also racing the Soviets at that point, and it escaped nobody's notice that during the 20 months Gemini was flying, the Soviets did not fly a single mission. Now, they had sprinted out way ahead of us. They had the first man in space. They had the first two-person spacecraft. They had the first two spacecraft mission. They had the first long-duration mission. They had the first woman in space. We didn't have a woman in space until 1984 when Sally Ride flew. But NASA caught up with them and exceeded them throughout the Gemini program. And, you know, after that, it was still technically a race, but the Americans were clearly in the lead, and it was Gemini that vaulted them there.
Jeffrey Kluger, just fascinating to talk to you. Thank you for spending the time with us and for this wonderful book.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for the attention to the book. I do hope it finds an audience.
Thanks again to our guest, author Jeffrey Kluger. His new book, Gemini, Stepping Stone to the Moon, The Untold Story, is published by Parnassus Books, and it's available through most major booksellers or order it at your favorite local bookstore. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises and licensed to California State University Chico in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.